Pentagon says no ambiguities have been left in the draft text of negotiations on the revival of JCPOA, adding that negotiators need a political will to come to a conclusion. Palestine says that the United Nations has openly sided with Israel. The world body has not included the regime on its blacklist for violating children's rights. And in France, President Macron's centrist party fails to make ground in the first round of the regional elections, marred by a record low turnout. Greetings and a warm welcome to World News. Good to have you with us. The Iranian Foreign Ministry has stressed that the 2015 nuclear deal between Tehran and several world powers will not be renegotiated. In his weekly press conference, the ministry's spokesman said that there are no ambiguities left in the draft text of the Vienna talks on the revival of the nuclear deal. Said Khatibzadeh says that negotiations require political decision by all parties to come to a conclusion. He stressed that Tehran's principal policy has been the removal of all U.S. sanctions at the earliest possible time. The Iran official again underlined the peaceful nature of Iran's nuclear program and slammed Washington for violating international law and its noncompliance attempts. On Sunday, negotiators from Iran and the remaining signatories to the nuclear deal wrapped up their sixth round of talks in the Austrian capital and headed back home for consultation.
The sixth round of talks to revive the nuclear deal known as the JCPOA comes to an end in Vienna. Delegates are headed back home for a short break, this time not for further consultations, says Iran's lead delegate, but for decision-making.
We are closer to a deal than any time in the past, but it doesn't mean that we are there. The remaining job is still difficult. Needs lots of efforts and further talks. So we decided to cut negotiations here, go back home, not only for consultations but this time for decision making.
The U.S. administration, represented by Robert Malley, has talked of a longer and stronger deal, but Iran has made it clear it will only agree to the restoration of the original JCPOA. A position reiterated by Russia.
It was agreed from the very beginning our aim was to restore the JCPOA in its original form. Nothing more and nothing less. So if you are talking about follow-on talks, it's something like JCPOA plus. And actually, for example, the issues of regional security in the Persian Gulf is a separate topic.
Iran is still demanding the removal of all U.S. sanctions, including those imposed additionally under former President Donald Trump after his withdrawal from the deal in 2018. Iran says it would only come back to full compliance after it can verify sanctions removal. It's also seeking guarantees the U.S. will not withdraw from the agreement again. Without such an assurance, Iran's Deputy Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi says, a return to the JCPOA will not be possible. Up until now, the U.S. has shown no signs it's willing to give that assurance. If a deal is to be reached in the next round or by mid-July, the right political decisions need to be made. Homolesky, Vienna.
The Atomic Energy Organization of Iran says that the country's Bushehr nuclear power plant has been temporarily shut down. It's also taken off the national power grid. The AEOI cited technical fault for the shutdown of the power plant in the southern port city of Bushehr. The plant will be connected to the power grid after the fault is fixed. This is expected to take a few days. The facility was commissioned in 2011, and it's Iran's only nuclear power plant. Palestine has slammed the UN decision not to include Israel on its blacklist of groups for violating children's rights. As the world body has openly sided with the regime. In a statement, Palestinian Foreign Ministry said that a UN's move would embolden the Tel Aviv regime to continue committing organized terrorism and crimes against humanity. It says the decision has undermined the UN credibility. The Palestinian Ministry urged the world body to add Israel to its blacklist, saying that the regime has grossly violated children's rights. Last month, the Tel Aviv regime launched a massive onslaught on the Gaza Strip, killing hundreds of civilians, 66 children, as well as dozens of women, were among the dead. Political commentators cite Zulfikar says that the UN decision not to add Israel to its blacklist was in effect a green light to the regime to kill children with impunity.
Of course, it can be interpreted as a green light of impunity that they can go on. Now, let's not forget that in 2014, when there was a last massive attack on Gaza, 561 children were murdered by Israeli bombing, and nearly 3,000 were wounded and some permanently maimed. The United Nations wrote a report at the time which stigmatized and condemned Israel, and yet there was, at the same time, exactly in June when this report was presented to the Security Council, there was, this in 2015, there was very heavy lobbying by the United States and its partner Israel among the member states not to put Israel on the list. You know that Saudi Arabia was on that list for having bombed children's hospitals and children's schools and buses in Yemen. And yet in 2020, a few months, exactly a year ago, Saudi Arabia was taken off the list of the list of shame by a very strong lobbying by the United States. So in fact, it's the United States that runs the show. It's they, through their financial blackmail, are able to get exactly what they want from the Security Council.
The Israeli army has targeted the Gaza Strip's infrastructure, including the main water treatment station, and this has contaminated the water resources there with untreated sewage, putting at risk the health of nearly 2 million Palestinians living in that impoverished enclave. Ruba Shabbat has a report.
Israeli forces carried out a full-scale military offensive against the Gaza Strip, targeting civilian areas and infrastructure in a clear violation of international humanitarian law. During this attack, Israel damaged paved roads and other infrastructure, including Gaza sewage treatment stations and networks. 18 sewage water pumps were damaged, and Gaza Central sewage treatment stations were unable to function as employees were unable to go to their workplace due to the intensity of the situation.
The Israeli regime destroyed most infrastructure in Gaza. Sewage treatment stations were among the targets of the Israeli regime, where one of our main stations was completely destroyed and the rest are partially damaged. Israeli airstrikes also damaged the electricity network that generates the treatment stations. This has polluted the sea with untreated sewage.
The Gaza Electricity Distribution Company recently announced that its power supply services will be intermittent due to the lack of fuel used to generate electricity caused by Israel's ban of entering fuel. With the limited capacity of power supply due to the Israeli airstrikes of electricity networks, sewage water is directly treated into the sea. As a result, nearly 2 million Palestinians in Gaza now face a serious public health emergency.
There is a huge damage in the electricity network of the Gaza Strip. Electricity turned into a problem for Gazans since 2006, when Israeli regime destroyed the only electricity plant. Since then, all aspects of our lives have been negatively impacted. The electricity condition is terrible due to the Israeli blockade that prevents entering fuel.
In Palestinian refugee camps, the condition is even worse, where residents of the camp are suffering the shortage of clean water and bad health conditions since the Israeli blockade was imposed for more than 15 years. This led to the increase of diseases among the residents.
This is a terrible condition here. We are left without water and electricity. We are stuck at home because Israel targets any moving thing. There isn't any water for drinking, cleaning, or any other purposes. Israel intends to target our infrastructure and the water station as a punishment for all Gazans.
In addition to the Israeli blockade imposed on the Gaza Strip for about 15 years, the continuous violence against civilians and infrastructure
has increased the suffering of 2 million Palestinians and undermined their rights of living and health. Ruba Shabet, Gaza.
The Yemeni army has released footage of its downing of a U.S. spy drone over the Nara province. Army spokesman Major Al-Sari said that the drone, known as Scan Eagle, was spotted and hit while flying over Mashjar region. The UAV was brought down using a land-to-air missile. The spokesman also underlined that the Yemeni armed forces will not hold back any effort to defend the country's skies against aggression. The last batch of U.S. troops will leave Afghanistan in just weeks, ending America's longest war. Former Afghan President Hamid Karzai has lambasted the 20-year U.S. military presence in his country. He says that Afghans would be better off without American troops. In our news review program, we've discussed the U.S. legacy in Afghanistan.
Afghanistan's former president slams the U.S. military campaign in his country, saying the mission has failed and left the war-ravaged nation in a state of, quote, total disgrace and disaster. Hamid Karzai said the United States failed to fight extremism and bring stability to Afghanistan nearly 20 years after arriving in the country. He noted that the U.S. mission was aimed at bombing Afghan villages and creating prisons. His comments come as the last batch of U.S. and NATO troops will leave the Central Asian country in weeks. Karzai said extremism is at its highest point, stressing that Afghans would be better off without, quote, the misery of U.S.-led military presence. In April, U.S. President Joe Biden announced the final withdrawal of the remaining troops, saying the military achieved its goals. Joining us is Sarah Flounders, activist and political writer from New York, and we also have Jason Anure, political commentator from Ontario. Welcome, Sarah. If I could start with you, harsh words for the U.S. there by the former Afghan president, saying that the America's legacy in the country is, quote, total disgrace and disaster. Well, what do you say to that?
Well, it is certainly and absolutely from day one a total disgrace and a disaster. And certainly Karzai should know he's one of the people responsible from the very beginning, from 2001, appointed as president, then put in place, and then elected through a process that the U.S. had every role in. So it really means that every Afghan official who had any relation the U.S. now also sees a complete disaster, and a disaster for themselves and all those who collaborated in this horrendous, horrendous occupation that has just led to tens of thousands of deaths of Afghan civilians, the bombing of villages, the complete destruction. It accomplished nothing except billions for the military industries. Nothing was accomplished for Afghanistan except for death and destruction and ruin.
Jason, the U.S. invaded Afghanistan some 20 years ago to topple the Taliban government. It's now negotiating with the very same militant group on the best way on how to withdraw from the country. What's your thoughts?
Well, this is certainly an acknowledgement by the United States that they've lost the war. I don't think that there's any honest person out there who could look at this and see it as some kind of a victory. The United States had vowed to destroy the Taliban, to remove them from the country permanently. Well, this has certainly not been the case. After nearly two decades of complete and total devastation, in the eyes of many, a genocidal operation to just obliterate 1.5 million people in the country, it is very clear that the United States did not achieve their stated objective, which was to remove the Taliban, and I have no doubt that that was their intention. However, their military contractors and weapons manufacturers certainly got what they were looking for in this situation. This is certainly an admission of defeat. They very clearly cannot win. After all this time, they've made no significant strides forward, and have made, for every step forward, they have a two steps back. Once the Taliban had readjusted to becoming guerrilla fighters once again after these past decades, they once again militarily have managed to hold the country much to the dismay of the countries, to the U.S. and the countries allied to it. But I think the fact that they are in negotiations with the Taliban shows very clearly that the U.S. lost the war.
Thank you very much indeed. Let's thank our guests for their contribution and thoughts. Sarah Flanders is an activist and political writer joining us out of New York, and also Jason Anurue, political commentator from Ontario. Thank you very much indeed, and thank you for joining this edition of the News Review.
Now moving on to this news broadcast, in France, President Emmanuel Macron's centrist party has failed to make ground in the first round of regional elections. The elections were marked by a record low turnout. Early results indicating Macron's LREM performed poorly, with a national vote just share of 10%. The far-right national rally party of Marie Le Pen also faltered, securing only 17% of the vote. And that's while center-right parties did better than expected, the main opposition party Republicans winning more than 27% of the vote. The election will determine new council for 14 regions and 96 departments. The vote came on the heels of more than a year of COVID lockdowns and restrictions after being delayed for 3 months. Polling agencies have projected a high abstention rate of more than 68% for the first round. A second round is due on June 27. I talked to our correspondent in Paris an hour ago. Kristen Hume says that the historical low turnout in France's regional elections is a response to President Macron's policies.
The main reason for the turnout is the judgment of the majority of the French people about the policy of the Macron government. They are not happy about the way he managed the health crisis, but also the way he managed the social crisis. So Macron has been focusing on security issues, on migrant issues, and apparently that did not work for the majority of the French people. This is a concrete sanction by the voters, especially by those who did not go to vote, sanction of the policy of Macron.
That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat, or BAT 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box 19395-6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Leader's speech in meeting with members of Assembly of Experts. This is part of a speech delivered on August 31, 2006 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with members of the Assembly of Experts.
On many global issues, particularly on regional issues, the initiative is in the hands of the Islamic Republic. The fact that the initiative is in the hands of the Islamic Republic is an unprecedented and unique phenomenon. It is not the case that the Islamic Republic waits for others to say something and then make a response in opposition to or in agreement with them. This is not the case. The Islamic Republic takes action and shows initiative. Fortunately, the events that have taken place have helped us as well. These events are really because of the divine assistance. The astonishing event in Lebanon is one of these events. The event of Lebanon was really the manifestation of when you threw a handful of dust, it was not your act, but Allah's. The Holy Quran, chapter 8, verse 17. Like blocks of iron, the Holy Quran, chapter 18, verse 96. God strengthened the divine hands of these youth in a way that this event became so great and important. The army of the Zionist regime was so strong that its powerful neighboring countries could not imagine that they could resist it, let alone delivering such blows to it. Not only was the Zionist enemy in Lebanon stopped, but it also received severe blows and it suffered a loss. They received these blows in the face of only part of Lebanese resources. It was disgraced and it failed to achieve even one-tenth of the goals that it had set itself. This is a very astonishing event. The enemies and opponents of Islam and Muslims are not willing to acknowledge it, but we can fully understand this from their statements. They have become shocked and stupefied. It is such a great event that they cannot understand and analyze it all. Of course, they want to discuss and analyze it and see how it happened, but it happened anyway. This was the divine help and assistance, and it was achieved with diligence and hard work. The same astonishment exists in Palestine itself. A few months before this event, it was easy to say that Hamas might achieve victory in the popular elections for forming the administration.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah. Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah.
Relations between the United States and Russia came under the spotlight this week as presidents of the two geopolitical rivals sat down for talks in Geneva. Before the meeting, Washington and Moscow had acknowledged that relations were at rock bottom. A series of tit-for-tat actions, which escalated in recent years, has left bilateral diplomatic ties in tatters. Moscow and Washington are at loggerheads over a host of issues, including the situation in Ukraine, arms control, human rights, and cybersecurity. The depth of differences between the two sides had dashed hopes of any breakthrough during the meeting between the U.S. President Joe Biden and his Russian counterpart Vladimir Putin. The Geneva talks lasted around 3 hours. The two presidents did not even come close to resolving any of the acrimonious conflicts that have sent U.S.-Russian ties to their lowest level in decades. However, Biden and Putin agreed to launch a dialogue on atomic arms control. They also said that they would return ambassadors to Washington and Moscow to ease diplomatic contacts. The ambassadors were withdrawn in March for consultations after Washington accused Moscow of interference in America's 2020 presidential election. That is a claim that Moscow vehemently denies. The agreements in Geneva this week have somehow reduced bilateral tensions for now, but it is definitely too early to know whether the two rivals will eventually engage in meaningful cooperation. The presidents of the U.S. and Russia hailed their dialogue in Geneva. The Russian president said Biden was an experienced statesman. But despite the pleasantries, deep differences persisted in the meeting and after that. There was almost no sign of agreement on issues like cybersecurity and Ukraine, where Russia and the West have been locked in a tug of war for years. Putin warned the U.S. against imposing new sanctions on Russia. Putin and Biden also clashed over human rights issues with the American leader, threatening devastating consequences for Moscow if Russian opposition leader Alexei Navalny, who is now serving a 2.5-year sentence, died in jail.
As we know, Washington loves to throw human rights violation allegations against everyone, which is now extremely ironic because the current official president of the United States and many Democrats around him acknowledge that the Black Lives Matter movement has legitimate gripes with the United States. And the Black Lives Matter movement is a movement that claims that the United States grossly violates the human rights of its own citizens.
Putin dismissed U.S. concerns about Navalny, telling Biden that the opposition leader had ignored the law. The Russian president also criticized the status of human rights in America. Putin specifically named the Black Lives Matter movement and the January 6th attack on Capitol as two cases that show the U.S. has its own grave human rights-related problems. Observers believe it is too soon to judge the outcome of the Geneva meeting.
can the two rivals somehow build on their recent meeting, bridge their differences, and hammer out compromises in the future?
If you look back to the 1990s, after the triumph in the Cold War, the United States sat down, well, certain important elites sat down and wrote the Project for a New American Century. And one of the absolute and most key points of that project to make the century completely American is to not allow a new competitor to rise. And when you have this sort of zero-sum game, 0-1, you know, win or lose sort of scenario, there's really no way to find any sort of true compromise or make any sort of friendly deal of any sort of meaning.
Bilateral talks on strategic arms limitations could start in a matter of weeks. The talks could serve as a test of the two sides' political will to engage in meaningful diplomacy and cooperation.
Iran's health minister, Saeed Namaki, announced on Monday that the Coviran Barakat coronavirus vaccine have received approval for public inoculations.
A legal commission gave approval to the Barakat vaccine for emergency use. The Barakat complex can now distribute the vaccines it's produced. God willing, the vaccine will be added to the national vaccination program starting next week.
He said that Iran had gone through nearly a year of intensive work to join the club of countries in the world with the capacity to scale up production for coronavirus vaccines. Coviran Barakat was unveiled on December 29, 2020, and started to be mass-produced on March 29. It's been developed by Shifa Farmid, a subsidiary of the Iranian economic and industrial conglomerate Sattar. The factory says its production capacity will reach 12 to 15 million doses per month in summer. Iran is among the first countries which started developing a vaccine against the coronavirus, and now four companies are endeavoring to release their products by September and inoculate the whole population.
The ability of Iran to develop its own vaccine is a step forward. It would have been a lot easier, I suspect, had there been no sanctions on some of the chemicals and other things needed to develop the vaccines. So I think we have to go back to these principles. If we are serious, if the United States is serious about moving forward to prevent the spread of this virus and to save lives, then there has to be an open-handed, generous, an honest relationship with Iran, with Cuba, with China and Russia and other makers of vaccines, including India and South Africa, all of which has been impeded by this emphasis on privatization and the maintenance of sanctions.
Iran hopes that domestic initiatives could significantly boost vaccine supplies for a nationwide inoculation program that started last year. The G7 summit in the United Kingdom ended with a pledge to distribute 1 billion doses of COVID-19 vaccine to the developing world, a figure that activists say is a drop in the bucket in the fight against the coronavirus pandemic. In the meantime, some Western nations have been accused of hoarding the vaccines, even though their inoculation programs have lost their momentum. Others are also accusing them of engaging in vaccine diplomacy, taking advantage of vaccine donations to seek diplomatic favors, something that even the Western countries have acknowledged.
There's no doubt that some of this going about, and we don't support vaccine diplomacy, let alone blackmail. We think that we've got a moral duty, but also strong vested interest in getting the world vaccinated, because we know no one's safe until we're all safe.
The major pharmaceutical companies are yet to grant a waiver on the intellectual property rights behind the production of their COVID-19 vaccines, a move that would facilitate poorer nations' access to the jabs. Meanwhile, nations like Iran and Cuba have joined forces to develop their vaccines to protect their population against the coronavirus pandemic.
Well, from my point of view, I think it's great that Iran has been able to develop a vaccine working with the Cubans and the Russians and others. And this is an important step. And I think it's one reason why the United States began to say the other day, about 3 weeks ago now, well, maybe we should relax the patents and so on and so forth. But the whole system in the last 18 months reduced the speed and the efficacy of the distribution of the vaccine.
As major vaccine producers keep away the doses from the rest of the world, vaccines built by developing countries can be a beacon of hope for millions of people.
Saudi authorities have executed a young man for crimes he allegedly committed as a teenager. Mustafa al-Darwish exhausted his final appeals at the end of May, and his execution was approved by the office of the Saudi king. In the last week of May 2021, Mustafa al-Darwish's case was referred to the Presidency of State Security. The judicial process around this case is not transparent. Human rights organizations, including Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, and the UK-based legal rights organization Reprieve, called al-Darwish's case particularly concerning. Saudi authorities claim he confessed to various crimes, but his family said he has not had adequate legal representation. Al-Darwish was arrested in 2015 for taking part in anti-government protests in the Katif region when he was 17. Charges against him included participation in armed rebellion against the rulers, forming an armed terrorist network, and seeking to disrupt national cohesion. According to reports, al-Darwish was placed in solitary confinement and held incommunicado for 6 months and denied access to a lawyer until the beginning of the trial 2 years later, violating his right to a fair trial. In March 2018, he was sentenced to death by the Specialized Criminal Court.
Mustafa al-Darwish was innocent. He only participated in a peaceful protest against the regime some 8-9 years ago, and he should not have been executed. Last week we signed a petition taken up by Reprieve and to stop the execution of this young man. But the Saudis were not in a mood to stop this, because they believe that their rule is based on bloodletting and killing of people. If the other people are not killed, then they fear that their rule may not survive. So today's execution is a crime, is an extrajudicial crime by the Saudis, for which they must be punished.
Al-Darwish was a member of Saudi Arabia's Shia Muslim minority. Rights groups say the Shia minority is persecuted by Saudi authorities and that the death penalty is used to quell dissent. Saudi authorities have used a heavy-handed approach against pro-democracy protests across the country. Most protests happen in the Katif region, which is populated by the country's Shia minority. Katif is situated in Saudi Arabia's eastern province. Since 2011, it has witnessed anti-regime demonstrations demanding free speech, release of political prisoners, and an end to economic and religious discrimination against the kingdom's minority Shia population.
They get the lion's share of persecution by the regime. They don't get fair representation of equal to their share of the population. They amount to about 20% of the population, but they don't have enough ministerial posts or members of parliament or senior membership, senior posts in the government. So it is undeniable. You cannot deny that the Saudi regime is very much sectarian, very much anti-Shia, very much unjust. Against, of course, the Shia, but also against every other citizen in that troubled country.
Riyadh has suppressed pro-democracy rallies that have intensified since January 2016, when Saudi Arabia executed respected Shia cleric Sheikh Nimr al-Nimr. It has also stepped up security measures, increasing politically motivated arrests, prosecution and conviction of peaceful dissident writers and human rights campaigners.
Well, they executed wrongly and unjustly Sheikh Nimr al-Nimr in January 2016. They killed Jamal Khashoggi in 2018, and they jailed women, many of them. One of them is now the Nasim al-Sadeh from Eastern Province, and she is still behind bars. And of course, there are many writers, commentators, journalists, and religious scholars, especially from the Muslim Brotherhood trend. So there are most sectors of society in the Arabian Peninsula are under the persecution of the Saudi regime, the House of Saud.
Since 2018, Saudi Arabia has had a law on the books preventing the death penalty for crimes committed by juveniles, but in practice is open to interpretation and can be circumvented. Lack of transparency in the Saudi legal system means that the conditions of the arrest can also change. Saudi Arabia is known as a world leader in capital punishment.
Iran's health minister, Saeed Namaki, announced on Monday that the Coviran Barakat coronavirus vaccine have received approval for public inoculations.
A legal commission gave approval to the Barakat vaccine for emergency use. The Barakat complex can now distribute the vaccines it's produced. God willing, the vaccine will be added to the national vaccination program starting next week.
He said that Iran had gone through nearly a year of intensive work to join the club of countries in the world with the capacity to scale up production for coronavirus vaccines. Coviran Barakat was unveiled on December 29, 2020, and started to be mass-produced on March 29. It's been developed by Shifa Farmid, a subsidiary of the Iranian economic and industrial conglomerate Sattar. The factory says its production capacity will reach 12 to 15 million doses per month in summer. Iran is among the first countries which started developing a vaccine against the coronavirus, and now four companies are endeavoring to release their products by September and inoculate the whole population.
The ability of Iran to develop its own vaccine is a step forward. It would have been a lot easier, I suspect, had there been no sanctions on some of the chemicals and other things needed to develop the vaccines. So I think we have to go back to these principles. If we are serious, if the United States is serious about moving forward to prevent the spread of this virus and to save lives, then there has to be an open-handed, generous, an honest relationship with Iran, with Cuba, with China and Russia and other makers of vaccines, including India and South Africa, all of which has been impeded by this emphasis on privatization and the maintenance of sanctions.
Iran hopes that domestic initiatives could significantly boost vaccine supplies for a nationwide inoculation program that started last year. G7 summit in the United Kingdom ended with a pledge to distribute 1 billion doses of COVID-19 vaccine to the developing world, a figure that activists say is a drop in the bucket in the fight against the coronavirus pandemic. In the meantime, some Western nations have been accused of hoarding the vaccines, even though their inoculation programs have lost their momentum. Others are also accusing them of engaging in vaccine diplomacy, taking advantage of vaccine donations to seek diplomatic favors, something that even the Western countries have acknowledged.
There's no doubt that some of this going about, and we don't support vaccine diplomacy, let alone blackmail. We think that we've got a moral duty, but also strong vested interest in getting the world vaccinated, because we know no one's safe until we're all safe.
The major pharmaceutical companies are yet to grant a waiver on the intellectual property rights behind the production of their COVID-19 vaccines, a move that would facilitate poorer nations' access to the jabs. Meanwhile, nations like Iran and Cuba have joined forces to develop their vaccines to protect their population against the coronavirus pandemic.
From my point of view, I think it's great that Iran has been able to develop a vaccine, working with the Cubans and the Russians and others. And this is an important step, and I think it's one reason why the United States began to say the other day, 3 weeks ago now, well, maybe we should relax the patents and so on and so forth. But the whole system in the last 18 months reduced the speed and the efficacy of the distribution of the vaccine.
As major vaccine producers keep away the doses from the rest of the world, vaccines built by developing countries can be a beacon of hope for millions of people.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
This is A to Z. An introduction to Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, knowledge versus ignorance. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. We know the best of the knowledges out there, out of all the benefit knowledge, is the knowledge of the Creator, the knowledge about Islam, the commandments of Islam, the responsibilities we all have in this life. This is the most precious form of knowledge. This knowledge ought to serve as a foundation of all other branches of knowledge and must be acquired by all Muslims. It should constitute the core of all Muslim basic or advanced integrative educational systems and programs, which are supposed to neglect no segment of human existence, the mission of one's life,
nor to treat some of them at the expense of others. Knowledge, which is also known as ilm, is a generic term that cannot be separated and compartmentalized along the religious or secular lines. In Islam, everything to various degrees is spiritually loaded. There is nothing that is in vain, totally irrelevant, and purposeless. So remember, you know how sometimes you talk about the secular knowledge versus the Islamic knowledge, secular sciences versus the Islamic sciences. Islam looks at all of the knowledge which is beneficial for a human being to be Islamic. Yes, there are degrees. Yes, there are different levels. Yes, there are superior and inferior forms of knowledges. But anything that is beneficial, any knowledge that is beneficial for human beings in this world or the hereafter, are considered to be Islamic sciences and Islamic knowledge. So we don't really believe in the segregation between the secular knowledge and Islamic knowledge. Everything beneficial is Islamic. Welcome back, dear listeners. Today we are discussing knowledge versus ignorance. And we said that all sciences that are beneficial for human beings, they have a different level of, you know, degrees and intensities and different levels and different forms and shape to be Islamic in nature. They are truly Islamic. So don't get messed up when we talk about, you know, the secular sciences, the secular knowledge, and versus the Islamic sciences and Islamic knowledge. Some people try to intend to do that. You know, when it comes to the jurisprudential laws, for instance, they are the only Islamic knowledge. Well, when it comes to nanotechnology, let's say, or satellite building and, you know, so on and so forth, that is all secular knowledge. No, that is not correct. It is a wrong approach. The correct approach is that any knowledge that is beneficial for humanity, any knowledge that is beneficial for human beings, it is considered to be Islamic. Islam is life, and life, as perceived and planned by its creator and planner, and the creator and planner of humanity and human destinies, is Islam. In Islam, there is only the truth and falsehood, light and darkness, as well as knowledge and ignorance. In the same way, alim or scholar is a person who knows or has mastered a field of knowledge, and in that capacity of its functions and supports the truth and its many ways, regardless of a life field in which he excels. Knowledge removes ignorance. Knowledge enlightens hearts and minds. So let's pray to Allah to make us knowledgeable, and we take those steps that are required to acquire the best of knowledges available. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z. Don't forget to log on to our website at www.parsetoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Subcontinent.
Hello everyone, this is Mehdi, and welcome to another episode of the Subcontinent.
Our program aims to address important issues in the subcontinent which affect the governments, people, organizations, and the region as a whole. We will try to explain the issues, break down controversies surrounding them, and try to have some external perspectives from experts and people.
In this edition of The Subcontinent, we are going to talk about the speculations over the future of Bangladesh's relations with the Israeli regime and its national repercussions. And we shall take a look at the efforts by the United States to establish greater military presence in Pakistan following the withdrawal from Afghanistan.
Recently, the Bangladeshi government made some seemingly bureaucratic modifications about Israel. It created such an outrage, or at least bafflement, that prompted the country's foreign ministry to reiterate that there is no change in travel policy towards Tel Aviv. However, given the recent developments inside the occupied territories, it might have been a test run to pilot the idea of formal diplomatic ties and see the feedback, because the wobbly new Israeli administration is in desperate need of a win.
A recent move by the Bangladeshi government to remove a clause from its electronic passports that barred its nationals from traveling to the Israeli-occupied territories has created uproar about the prospects of normalizing ties with the regime. Although Dhaka says nothing has changed in its stance or foreign policy about the Israeli regime, the controversial decision shocked the Muslim nation, especially because lately Israel is under global condemnation for its recent war against the Palestinian people. Speculations over opening diplomatic ties with Israel have not been uncommon following a US-sponsored deal for Arab-Israeli normalization. Since the agreement, Washington and its allies have stepped up their efforts to force more and more countries to establish relations with the Israeli regime. The UAE, Bahrain, Morocco, and Sudan have already established diplomatic and economic relations, while reports suggest that some other Persian Gulf states, Saudi Arabia, and even Pakistan may be also weighing their options regarding formal ties.
Removing the Accept Israel clause from the e-passports came as a shocking betrayal to the nation, but was greatly welcomed by the Israeli regime, which used the opportunity to call for formal relations with the Muslim country. Bangladesh says its position has not changed, and Dhaka would never recognize Israel until Palestine is established as an independent and sovereign country free of any occupation forces. So why did they move to facilitate relations? Why did they do it without telling people? And was the government hiding its ties from the nation?
Since Bangladesh's independence from Pakistan in 1971, the Muslim country has only recognized Palestine as a state, and the older Bangladeshi passports used to bear the sentence, "This passport is valid for all the countries of the world except Israel." In January last year, Bangladesh was among the first in South Asia and the 119th in the world to introduce the e-passport, a travel document with a small integrated circuit or chip embedded in the cover or pages. 6 months ago, when the South Asian country rolled out its new e-passport, the phrase was removed without any public announcement, and the information came to light only when Israeli officials started hailing Dhaka's move to lift the travel ban on Israel. Bangladesh's Home Minister Asaduzzaman Khan Kamal soon after acknowledged the change, saying that his government removed the words to ensure that the passports meet international standards. Foreign Minister A.K. Abdul Momen said, "The passport is just an identity and it doesn't reflect the foreign policy of a country." He said although Tel Aviv approached Dhaka for recognition and building bilateral ties on several occasions, Bangladesh's policy is still that of the father of the nation, Bangabandhu Sheikh Mujib. Bangladesh never recognizes Israel as long as Palestine is not established as a sovereign state free on any occupation army.
Now to have more insight, we are joined by Dr. Sabir Abu Maryam, Secretary